Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with revelations in Monday's New York Times that for decades, Afghan President Karzai has been receiving tens of millions in secret monthly cash payments from the CIA. Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point, joins us to discuss where the money went and what the U.S. got in exchange for these payments of taxpayer money. Then we will speak with a former CIA station chief in Kabul, Afghanistan, Graham Fuller, who is the author of The Future of Political Islam and A World Without Islam. We will discuss the legacy of our recent intervention in Iraq, which appears poised to resume in a civil war, and Afghanistan, where after the U.S. withdrawal in 2014, the country will likely revert to civil war. Having riled up 1 billion Muslims from our failed and futile interventions in Muslim lands, we will examine the possibility of future blowback. Then finally, in remarks today on the 150th anniversary of the National Academy of Sciences, President Obama promised to protect science research from politics at a time when Lamar Smith, the Texas Republican who is chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, is demanding that the National Science Foundation justify its research. John Cohen, who is a correspondent with Science Magazine and author of Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos, joins us to discuss the latest anti-intellectual assault on science. Joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And Monday's New York Times has a front page story revealing how the CIA paid bags, satchels, knapsacks full of cash to Hamid Karzai over a considerable period of time, while at the same time, Karzai, of course, is double-dipping, getting cash from the Iranians. So what did we get for the cash, do you know?
Yeah, so we should clarify, to the best of our knowledge, he's no longer taking cash from the Iranians. When that story broke, I think that a few years ago, the Iranians stopped sending cash to Hamid Karzai. To the best of our knowledge, it's not clear that Karzai himself had pocketed any of the cash, but instead what we think has happened is that he's used those monies to pay off the so-called warlords. So, for example, individuals like Dostum allegedly are receiving something on the order of $100,000 a month. Some people will lowball that estimate. Some people say that $100,000 is too high. But whatever it is, it's going to be a large figure, perhaps, in that order of magnitude. And so, you know, essentially what Karzai operates, or at least he's supposed to operate, and that's part of our understanding with him, is a patronage network. And this patronage network, there are people who are important for regime stability. You want to buy people off so that they're not doing things that they would otherwise be doing. And all of this just takes money to make sure that Karzai remains there alive in that position. This isn't so terribly different from what the Soviets did actually with Najibullah. And to really have an appreciation for how important these patronage payments are to warlords, potential rivals, and as well as to allies that you want to continue to have as allies. When the Soviet Union stopped providing Najibullah with those fundings, basically his regime collapsed. He was able to stay in place for several years, actually, even after the Soviet troops withdrew. What was central to regime survival was, in fact, those payments. So this isn't entirely new. Historians of Afghanistan certainly should not be surprised. I would have been surprised if we weren't making those funds available so that Karzai could pay off his allies and nemesis alike.
Well, of course, Karzai himself, to the surprise of many, on Monday at the presidential palace, came out and made a statement that the CIA cash had been used for different purposes, such as operations, assisting wounded Afghan soldiers, and paying rent. I guess he's putting a good face on it, right?
I mean, I don't see any reason why he should, in any way. I don't understand what his incentive would be to deny getting these funds. You know, in some sense, the CIA has been paying for a whole lot of things in Afghanistan. You may recall a number of years back, there was quite the fiasco when it was learned that the CIA had also been paying his brother down in Kandahar, who was the poppy kingpin, even while the DEA was investigating him. So this is sort of old news, at least to this reader.
And that was the brother who was killed by one of his disgruntled bodyguards.
Exactly.
And who was basically, the word gangster comes to mind, warlord, whatever. I mean, the guy that...
Well, since he was working with us, of course, we called Ahmed Wali Karzai a strong man.
A strong man,
one of my favorite nomenclatures. When we don't like them, they're warlords, but when we work with them, they're strong men.
Well, and the other strong man we work with, who apparently Karzai pays off to the tune of at least $100,000 a month, is General Dostum.
Of course.
And he's famous for putting his prisoners in a pit, buried up to their necks, and driving 9-inch nails into their heads as he interrogates them. So,
the thing to remember: all of these so-called warlords are essential war criminals. Even Ahmed Shah Massoud, who is frequently lamented as the loss of a great hero, even he was a war criminal. People don't realize, or if they did, they forgot, that if you were to go to Kabul on September 11th, 2001, the city was destroyed. The city was destroyed not by the Soviets from their occupation during the 1980s, but rather through the internecine warfare that was fought amongst the different so-called warlords, the Jung Bazi, namely the Northern Alliance under Ahmed Shah Massoud, as well as Hekmetyar, and of course Dostum was at that time aligned with Ahmed Shah Massoud. So again, this story is, you know, oddly enough, it's pretty old. In fact, even before 9/11, the United States had been paying off money to Ahmed Shah Massoud, trying to get him to cooperate with U.S. intelligence agents to try to operate against the Taliban and Mullah Omar. So in some sense, you know, from the beginning of conflict in Afghanistan, this war has been fought really with pallets of money coming in from the CIA.
In the case of Massoud, of course, he was double-dipping with the Russians.
Oh, absolutely. But when it came to the Taliban during this period, we were actually on the same side. The Russians and the Indians were supporting Ahmed Shah Massoud, as were we. So at least in that window of time, we largely wanted the same thing, which is to undermine the Taliban authority and to make sure that the Northern Alliance under Ahmed Shah Massoud remained stable and capable of resisting further Taliban pushes.
And, of course, Massoud was killed on the eve of 9/11.
Yep.
So, again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So, the initial question is, of course, what did this money get us? The broader question is, what has the billions in treasure and the thousands of lives and the hundreds of thousands, perhaps, I don't know what the Afghan casualties have been, what has that gotten us?
Okay, so answering the question very narrowly, if you take the supposition that it is an inherent American interest that the Karzai government remain in place, that Karzai not be assassinated, for example, then you will pretty much take for granted that there needs to be a way of Karzai paying off these various patronage networks to keep these folks loyal to him and to keep at least his enemies on the payroll, right? So if you believe that Karzai is central to this entire effort, then it's really not difficult to imagine how it is that enabling him to make these patronage payments would be in the service of U.S. interests. All right, so narrowly, that's not so crazy to me. This is largely how, you know, people deal with strong men. And in some ways, you know, that's what Karzai is. But I think if you look at the larger question, this is where one cannot help but be cynical. There's really nothing that we've built in Afghanistan that is not reversible. We know about the industrial strength corruption. So in some sense, the CIA payments so that he can pay off foes and friends alike, they really pale in comparison to the industrial strength corruption. So on the one hand, while Karzai has to pay off these folks to make sure that he remains in place, what's perhaps less appreciated is that he's also overseeing this vertically integrated extraction mechanism where money comes in at lower levels of governance, perhaps through USAID contracts, through money spent at the provincial reconstruction teams, through the commander's emergency response program or what have you. And whereas in a patronage system, money gets paid down so that you're paying off your patrons, right? What Karzai has also erected is this the opposite infrastructure, where money is being extracted from lower levels to increasingly higher levels, and then it's being ferreted out of the country. And so in some sense, what we've done is we've subsidized a very luxurious Plan B for Karzai and his allies. You know, these monies have largely gone to Europe. They've gone to Dubai. And this has been well documented by the U.S. Treasury. I mean, we know that the money that's being ferreted out of Afghanistan on a daily basis is far in excess of the actual monies that the state itself is capable of generating.
Well, surely, though, at some point or other, perhaps when we start pulling out, there'll be some kind of reckoning. Do you think there will be in terms of the lives lost, the treasure wasted?
No, there'll be no reckoning. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, this Koinista fantasy, and you and I have had numerous discussions about this over the last several years.
That's the counterintelligence.
Yes, the counterinsurgency mafia. You know, they were so insistent upon promoting the surge in Afghanistan. They promised up and down that with just, you know, 40,000 more troops, we can defeat the Taliban and so forth. We have yet to see any of those individuals who are, as far as I'm concerned, are just rank scoundrels. They've not been held to account. And not only that, they're being given the opportunity to rewrite history even as we experience it. So all of them are penning memoirs explaining how it wasn't that their idea was flawed, it's but that the execution was flawed. It's just ridiculous. The idea from the get-go was a bad idea. So I don't anticipate seeing any sort of reckoning, if for no other reason than every year Congress had to continue funding this fiasco. And for there to be a reckoning, that would essentially mean that Congress would have to take a look at how this happened, given the fact that for much of this war, you know, it was done under continuing resolutions. There were numerous opportunities for Congress to weigh in on this, and yet Congress kept writing the check. So I don't think there's going to be any accountability. But the question that really does arise is the end game after 2014. We've built this massive state in Afghanistan. Even when the Soviets left, the state that they had built was substantively smaller, and they were paying a smaller fraction of the recurring costs to Najibullah when they left. So what we have built is this massive overgrown state, and we're paying almost all of the recurring costs. So this raises the question of what happens to, for example, the Afghan National Security Forces. Who knows what the exact number is, because, again, there's no genuine accountability on that issue. But when the ANSF doesn't get paid, what will they do? They'll basically collapse around their different commanders, who are in many cases warlords. And so essentially what will happen if we don't continue paying the recurring costs of the ANSF is that we've kind of written this future history of the next civil war with these different ANSF commanders breaking out, forming their own militias and going at it as they sort of divide up the spoils of, you know, in some sense a retrograde state.
But Chris Fair, will that happen whether we pay them or not? In other words, I don't believe the Obama administration is advertising the fact that when the boots on the ground have left, we're still going to be making these massive payments. So there are two questions. One, is this what's going on, that under the radar we'll keep paying for this quagmire in Afghanistan? And two, will the cash make any difference, whether or not they revert back to warlordism and chaos?
Okay, so that's the key question. So as I said, with respect to Najibullah, the reason why he was able to stay in power, even though the troops left, was that the Soviets were paying him. And he wasn't using those funds to feather his own nest. In fact, he was paying those funds to keep key facilities of the state operational. For example, he made sure that the security forces were getting paid. He made sure that key officials in the Ministry of Interior were getting paid. that's how Najibullah was able to survive, even though there were no Soviet troops. When that money was cut off, his regime fell, and the country lapsed into this internecine warfare amongst the different warlords. The problem that we have with Karzai, and if I were confident that Karzai were Najibullah, and let's remember, Karzai's term ends in 2014. We're going into uncharted territory. We don't know what an Afghanistan looks like without Karzai, unless he does something really bizarre that allows him to remain as president. It's not going to be Karzai in the presidency in 2014 when we withdraw. So we're really in uncharted territories. As I said, Karzai does two things. He takes the CIA and Iranian, although we don't think they're still paying the Karzai government, as well as any other tranche of funds, and he pays off certain people. But what Karzai has really built is this vertically integrated money hoover that sucks up money from the lowest levels and yanks it out of the country. So paying, continuing to allocate money to pay the recurring costs of this gigantuan sort of out-of-control rentier state only makes sense if we think Karzai and his, well, actually his replacement, is going to use those monies to pay off the key elements of state that need to be paid off to keep the place from falling into chaos and civil war. If Karzai were to be in that position after 2014, I would not be optimistic that the U.S. writing those checks would, in fact, secure regime stability, because everything that we've seen from the Karzai government has been about taking money from the international community and sucking it out of Afghanistan and putting it into... And by the way, Karzai is not the only one who does this. The Taliban have done this too. Everyone has their poppy palaces in Dubai, throughout the Gulf and in Europe. So I think the question of whether or not the United States should continue paying the recurring costs of the government will in large measure depend upon whether or not the person who's in place in 2014 is going to run a patronage network or whether he's going to run a vertically integrated hoover to take the money out of Afghanistan to feather nests elsewhere. And I think it's just really too early to say because, as I said, we're really moving into uncharted waters in a post-Karzai Afghanistan.
Again, Chris Fair, former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So since Karzai and his cronies have sent their money to Dubai and elsewhere, what incentive do they have to stay if the going gets tough?
They have no incentive. I mean, they'll be on the penultimate helicopter out of the country. And so he has no incentive to stay. In fact, if I were Karzai, I would abdicate I would vacate the presidency before my term even ended. Leaders don't, you know, he will be the first president to actually step down from a position of power voluntarily if he should serve out his term. So, you know, if Karzai actually is planning on staying in Afghanistan, he has taken none of the steps that would suggest that he has created an environment in which he can survive. I think that's why he's been largely, not just him, his entire family, his entire patronage network, have been really building this plan B outside of Afghanistan. Now, you know, if we could have thought this through in the beginning and could we have built some regime that would have denied him asylum or access to an exit visa, but I don't think that's legal. We may have forced him to sleep in the bed in which he has made. But, you know, under the prevailing legal regime that governs international community, no, he has feathered his bed elsewhere, and I suspect that's where he's going to go when he's no longer in power.
And he tried to sort of finagle these elections and find a way to stay on, but surely he's in a position to find some handpicked successor, doesn't he?
No, well, yes and no. So he can't stay on. Per the Afghan constitution, the president is limited to two terms. Mm-hmm. His first term was, of course, as interim president. So unless there's a constitutional amendment, he can't contest the elections again. There was some speculation that he had been massively rigging the provincial elections that took place in 2010 in hopes that he would get a compliant parliament that would push through an amendment that would allow him to contest a third time, but that didn't come to fruition. in part, you know, you don't have political parties per se in Afghanistan, so it's actually very difficult to get a consensus on anything, coercively or non-coercively. So I don't really think that's an option. In terms of him picking a hand-picked successor, you know, Afghanistan is a really difficult electoral environment. The first-past-the-post system makes it very difficult to actually have elected officials that officials who actually have a reasonable level of support in their different constituencies. So, I mean, we'll see. I mean, what you really have to have in the successor is someone who is going to be a Pashtun, who will bring along the South, someone who's not going to be terribly punitive towards the Taliban. And then, of course, you need to have someone that can also work with the ethnic Tajiks and Uzbeks. And it's really not so straightforward coming up with an individual who can really satisfy these different conflicted electorates.
Well, just in closing, Christopher, what's happening vis-a-vis the exit, the physical exit of all that material, which, of course, is not going to amount to anything in terms of nation building? You've made that case. It's a rentier state, and it's no better or worse off than it was. Except, I guess, there's some more palaces in Kabul than there
Dubai.
Was,
and or also Kabul, yes,
and Dubai. There is so much war material there that the Pakistanis have been gouging the U.S. in terms of getting it out. I believe they've developed a route through the stands. So where does that stand in getting all of that that equipment out?
Well, I think what's going to happen very quickly is that there's an increasingly sobering of the decision-making about what we're going to get out of Afghanistan and what we're simply going to leave in place. You know, anyone who's been to Afghanistan sees that the countryside is literally littered with tanks, armored personnel carriers. You know, the detritus of the Soviet war is still completely present in Afghanistan, not to mention, I might add, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of mines. The number of mines in Afghanistan is absolutely staggering. I think when the Americans began thinking about withdrawal, the intention was to not do a redux of the Soviet Union and basically leave all of this crap in place. But it costs money to get that stuff out. And as you said, our relationship with Pakistan is very much deteriorated. The idea is that we don't want to send any sensitive material through Pakistan, both because we fear that it's going to be pilfered and used by the terrorist groups in Pakistan, which are numerous and expanding, it seems, on a daily basis. And the route through the stands, the so-called northern route, is incredibly expensive because ultimately, You've got to be able to stick stuff on a boat. And so getting stuff to the stands requires multiple agreements with multiple countries. And at the end of the day, this is really a NATO-Russia pissing match. So we're kind of trading off one problem for another problem. And then obviously moving the stuff out through air routes is prohibitively costly. So we already saw them make the announcement last week that the mine resistant, what is it, the MRAP, the mine resistant ambush protected vehicle, which really saved a lot of lives in Afghanistan, are going to be left in place. Part of it is because the Americans don't anticipate being in another theater where they need the MRAPs, but also getting them out is going to be incredibly expensive.
Well, Chris Fair, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. And we're going to continue this conversation in a moment after a break with the CIA's former station chief in Kabul.
Read it all. And where's all the money gone? Where's all the money gone? Or have I got things added up all wrong? Did she break the little nest egg that I was sitting on? Where's all the money gone? gone? Where's all the money gone?